I'm starting to feel pretty sick. I think we gotta end the crazy journey here. Plus, it's almost Christmas now, so maybe we should listen to a little Christmas music.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
I'm going to start today with the prototypical story, really, that is an objectively important story to understand what's going on in the economy and that almost no one cares about and almost no one will watch or engage with. But it doesn't matter. It's actually an important story, so we're going to start with it. And the story is that the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates by what's called sometimes 50 basis points or 0.5%. When they say 50, what they mean is 0.50%. This is the biggest increase in 22 years since the year 2000. And so much of what's going on today that is flippantly mentioned in so many of these 2022 debates that you can tell the candidates don't really understand comes down to understanding what is the impact of raising or lowering the federal funds rate. And so that's what we're going to talk about. And before I get into the details, yesterday we watched and we live streamed the 2022 Pennsylvania Republican Senate primary debate. This is the one with Mehmet Oz and Dave McCormick and Carla Sands and Kathy Barnett, etc. Bartos, I think, is the fifth guy. Now I'm actually remembering their names. And they were asked, all of them asked, about inflation and balancing the budgets and the economy and so many different things. And all five of them expressed no knowledge whatsoever of how these basic tools that are available to different government entities work, with the exception of at one point, Mehmet Oz mentioned raising the rate to lower inflation. And that was true, but then he moved on and went beyond it. So let's jump into the details and then we'll explain what's going on. Yahoo Finance report. Fed raises interest rates 0.5%, largest move since the year 2000. Good. This is the short-term interest rate. This is an effort to tamp down on the inflationary pressures weighing on Americans. The central bank suggested it will further raise borrowing costs throughout this year as it attempts to undo its pandemic era easy money policies. The policy setting Federal Open Market Committee also detailed plans on unwinding its nearly $9 trillion balance sheet. The raising of rates 0.5% is the most aggressive increase in a single meeting since May of 2000. Over the last two decades, the Fed has opted to raise interest rates in increments of 0.25% only. So let's talk about this. How does the rate goes up and inflation goes down? How does that work? Well, when you raise the federal funds rate, you make it more expensive for banks to borrow money. When it's more expensive for banks to borrow money, they in turn make it more expensive for people like you and me and businesses to borrow money. When it's more expensive for us to borrow money, we do less borrowing. And when you see the ways in which this is impactful, it will start to make intuitive sense. So if it becomes more expensive to get a mortgage, that's one form of borrowing, that makes a $300,000 house more expensive. What I mean by that is the house might be $300,000 either way, but if my mortgage on it is 5.25% instead of 5%, now that same $300,000 house is more expensive for me. So instead of spending $300,000 on a house, I might only spend $290,000. So that pushes down people's budgets and it can push down housing prices or at least slow down the increase. That's one component. Vehicles, car loans. If car loans are more expensive, you might be less likely to get a car loan, or if you do, you'll get a cheaper car. That pushes down on price increases. It discourages spending and it can lower inflation. Now, many people will say, but David, it can also slow down the economy. Well, How does that work? Same principle. One of the ways that an economy grows is by people investing in their own businesses. Oftentimes people borrow to invest in their business. Imagine that I want to start a shoe business and I need a factory and I need to borrow in order to build that factory. Well, if it's more expensive to borrow, I'm less likely to do it, or I'm less likely to borrow as much, meaning that instead of maybe having $400,000 to build my factory, which would go to contractors and lawyers and insurance and local businesses, now I only have $300,000. So I'm slowing down economic growth in that way. It always is the case that every one of these decisions is a double-edged sword. It is always the case. And so very often you see hyper-partisan discussions where we shouldn't raise rates because that will slow down the economy. Right, but it could also lower inflation, which many of you claim to want to do. Well, we shouldn't lower rates because it makes it too easy to borrow, and therefore it will cause inflation. Well, yes, that's the way it works. That's the double-edged sword. And the whole strategy, the whole trick of it, is to keep these things in balance. One other way in which raising the funds rate discourages spending, and it can both lower inflation but slow down the economy. If anybody has a savings account, I was going to call it a high yield savings account, but there's very little high yield about it. Many so-called high yield savings accounts over the last couple of years at the most pay about 0.5%. There's a number of high yield savings account where you can earn 0.5%. Not a great incentive to just store your money because it's lower than inflation. If the federal funds rate goes up 0.5%, and thus high yield savings accounts pay you more interest, you might lean a little more towards, now I'm more okay just saving the money and earning the interest because the interest rate is a little bit higher. And instead of putting that money into the economy, you just save it. So that's another aspect to this. Every single one of these things can have multiple effects. And that is the importance of raising the federal funds rate. So we'll see what the impact is. And we will see what forthcoming additional increases there are. And we've been warned to expect more. I hope that that's clear or at least relatively simple. If it's not, let me know. And also let me know if these types of segments are useful. There is another audio recording of House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who's a Republican, making it very clear that he wants Trump out. This is truly incredible stuff. And it's not improving my opinion of McCarthy. It's actually worsening it. And I'll explain why. New audio reports CNN. McCarthy said 25th Amendment takes too long. In other words, the 25th Amendment would take too long to remove Trump. He wanted, as a Republican who publicly supported Trump, privately, McCarthy wanted Trump removed. Wanted to reach out to Biden after the January 6th attack. This is incredible. House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy discussed the 25th Amendment. This is a mechanism to remove a sitting president. On a call with Republican leadership days after the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol, and said the process takes too long, according to audio obtained by the New York Times and shared with CNN. He also said he wanted to reach out to then-President-elect Biden to hope for a smooth transition, and said he thought an impeachment would further divide the nation. Let's listen to that audio, revealed yesterday to CNN by the New York Times reporters. This is incredible stuff.
From the standpoint, we're 12 days away. I mean, the one point I make with Biden, if you have an impeachment and you're stuck sitting in the Senate and he needs cabinet members, you've got Secretary of Defense, you've got a lot of things that you've got to have moving. And if you think from a perspective, you put everything else away, this country is very, very divided. I do think the impeachment divides the nation further and continues to divide even greater. That's why I want to reach out to Biden. I wanted the president to meet with Biden, but that's not going to happen. I want to see about us meeting with Biden and sitting down, make a smooth transition, show that, and continue to keep those statements going. So hopefully, I know he's going to talk to Pelosi, but hopefully he calls me today and see if we can start that process.
This is incredible stuff, truly. Okay, and that's the end of the clip. This makes these people look way worse. So every time we learn something like this, there's kind of two perspectives, right? There's, well, one perspective is these people aren't as crazy as we thought, in the sense that they realized how dangerous Trump was and they actually did want him gone. That's one perspective. They're not as bad. The other perspective is these people are even worse, because it's not that they genuinely believed Trump won and the riots were good and all this different stuff. They knew the opposite was true, but they continued publicly saying the things that they had to say in order to stay in Trump's good graces or whatever the case may be. I believe that the latter is accurate. These people are worse because Kevin McCarthy knew better. He knew better. He was saying it. He was on the phone with Liz Cheney. He was on the phone with whoever. And he continued to pander and to risk American democracy because of whatever selfish or self-centered reasons made him do it publicly. He says, oh, it was atrocious and it was totally wrong what Trump did. We got to look at the 25th Amendment. And yet publicly, he just continued to do his thing and say, no, everything's good. Republicans are good. Everything's good. So is it a desire for power and money and continuing to have access to the president that influenced it? Is there some connection? And we're speculating here between whatever made Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham 180 on Trump. Remember, those were not people who ever supported Trump early. And then all of a sudden they love Trump. They think he's great. Is there some connection between that and whatever kept McCarthy publicly supporting Trump? Could it be as simple as polling? They saw, listen, most of the base supports this guy, so we've got to support this guy. All of this confirms McCarthy is sane enough to know about the toxicity and the atrocity of Trump, and yet he still actively chose to allow it, and that makes him, I believe, worse than if he was a true believer. And this kind of gets back to the conversation we've been having for a week or two now about what's worse, the true believers or the false believers. The 25th Amendment was exactly for situations like these, where the president has become so compromised, he can't think straight. He can't discharge his duty as president of the United States. He's lost his mind. And some of the people closest to him, I guess they knew it had been enough, but they chose not to act. And they continue, Republicans do, to tell Democrats now that they've got to clean up the mess, that it's actually Republicans and Trumpists who created. Now, one other question. We've been playing these recordings of Kevin McCarthy for weeks now. Has Fox even talked about them? Do Fox News viewers even know that these recordings exist? I genuinely don't know the answer. I mean, it's not like I sit around and watch Fox. Do they have any idea of what we've learned from these recordings over the last few weeks? I don't know the answer to that. But if the answer is no, this goes to our story about two Americas that exist. And it's very, very disturbing stuff. Let me know your thoughts. You can find me on Twitter at @DPacman. We are an audience-supported program. And on that note, I'd love for you to support the work that we do. The daily podcast, YouTube clips, TV show, radio show, live streams, premium newsletter, all of the different things. The easiest way is to sign up at joinpacman.com. It's quick. It's easy. There's no big company taking 10, 20, 30% slices of every dollar. We keep everything but a 2.9% payment processing fee, and you can get a discount using the coupon code Obamna.
Obamna.
Major discount. In fact, I won't even tell you how big of a discount it is. It's a little, it makes me blush how big of a discount it is. You can sign up at joinpacman.com. President Joe Biden is under fire because he said that the so-called MAGA crowd is the, quote, most extreme political group in U.S. history. And he is exactly right. And I know many of you will say, but sir, what about the KKK? Or what about the... I am going to get to that in a moment. Let's take a look first at what Joe Biden said. Axios reporting President Biden on Wednesday said the MAGA crowd is really the most extreme political organization that's existed in American history, while speculating on how conservative state legislatures could respond to a potential Supreme Court ruling that would drastically curtail abortion access. This was when Biden was taking questions from reporters about the leaked draft opinion of the Roe v. Wade decision. Let's take a look at this video and what Joe Biden said, and then we will discuss.
What happens if you have a state change the law saying that children who are LGBTQ can't be in classrooms with other children?
Right.
Is that legit under the way the decision is written? What are the next things that are going to be attacked? Because this MAGA crowd is really the most extreme political organization that's existed in American history, in recent American history.
Okay. So he clarifies and says in recent American history. Now, I actually think the addition of recent is important, and I'll get back to what I think of when he says recent. But let's talk about it, because Joe Biden is correct. I've been saying this for a long time, and I'm glad that he is saying it. So let's take the obvious counterpoint. Well, what about a group like the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, for example? The KKK was not an actual prominent political group in recent American history. The KKK, if you've looked at KKK history, there's sort of like different, they call them like the first Klan, the second Klan, the third Klan. The estimated peak of the second Klan was in the mid-1920s, and it's estimated that at that point, the KKK had 3 to 6 million members, only some of whom actually voted. So as a political, first of all, you could say it's not even really a political movement, but let's say it is. Even as a political movement, there were 74 million people who voted for President Trump in 2020. And a ton of them are part of what we would call the MAGA movement. Not all. I mean, there are some Republicans there who just didn't like Hillary and they didn't like Biden. But we're talking about a group that at least at the top line is 74 million people. The peak of the second Klan was 3 to 6 million in the 1920s. More recently, the Anti-Defamation League estimates that there's about 30 active KKK groups with like 3 to 6 thousand members. So statistically, I mean, Joe Biden is correct. This is the most extreme political group. And the only confusion to me is, why did Biden think or say that he could, quote, work with them as he did during the campaign? Maybe he just felt he had to say it. And I would understand that it may not be well received if you're Biden and you know you can't work with these lunatics. If during your campaign you go, I don't even intend to listen to these people, it probably doesn't play well. So I understand that. Now, let's talk about the addition of in recent history. If we think back to the Civil War, and many of you will immediately know where I'm going with this, the Confederacy. Do you have to go back to the Confederacy to find a political movement as extreme as MAGA? I think maybe you do. And so that's why the kind of addition of recent history by Joe Biden maybe clarifies or even puts a better kind of point on it. The question I am concerned with, and I know many of you are concerned with because you email me about it all the time, is, okay, how do we deprogram them? How do we de-radicalize millions of people? And we've talked about techniques before. We've talked about empathy, listening, building relationships. This takes a really long time. It's got to be done basically one-on-one or maybe one-on-two or something like that. But in order to really de-radicalize MAGA, and by de-radicalize, I mean, they're only held together by their radicalism. So when we say de-radicalize, we're probably talking about an evaporation of the movement. You have to deal with Steve Bannon, Roger Stone, Trump himself, Michael Flynn, Fox News, InfoWars, Newsmax, OAN, Dan Bongino, Ben Shapiro, Breitbart, all of these different things, as well as the social media algorithms that amplify the stuff that they post. If you don't deal with that, you're not going to fix it. The problem is, I don't think we can just start deplatforming. I just don't think so. Not only does it go against some of our principles, importantly, but it would cause a backlash. It would potentially cause a significant increase of physical violence from the devoted MAGAs. So, you know, don't get me wrong. Everybody who's committed a crime, January 6th, Trump riots, terroristic threats, all these different things. Charge them, throw the book at them, etc. But just like a mass deplatforming movement isn't in line with leftist values, and it also wouldn't be effective. So I don't think that's the answer. And then that leaves us with the question of, well, what is the answer? And we don't know. We don't always have the answers. And the reason I've been interviewing cult experts, conspiracy experts, etc., is to try to get ideas about what might actually work. Always open to hearing ideas from you as well. I want to play a few clips for you today of a monstrous Donald Trump being interviewed by the Christian Broadcasting Network and declaring himself a Christian savior. this is really a wild God complex that Donald Trump has. It's like a Jesus complex, I guess you would say. Let's start with this first clip where Trump claims no one ever has done more for Christianity and for all religions than Trump himself.
You know, nobody has done more for Christianity. Nobody has done more for religion of all type than me. And they're really doing things now too. And I've always said it. They are against organized religion. They're against Christianity.
And of course, no, we're not. What we are against is civil law based on Christian doctrine. We're against enmeshing church and state. We're against discrimination against non-Christians or simply non-believers. Remember, non-religion is protected, and the absence of religion is equally protected. But Trump with a real God complex. Now, I do want to say, I don't think Trump is the person who's done the most for Christianity and all religions, as he claims. But if indeed the leaked Supreme Court decision holds, and I believe it will, we know it's an accurate draft, but it's a draft from February. If it holds in a few weeks when it's released and Roe v. Wade is overturned, Trump will be responsible for one of the major accomplishments. I would call it a major coup, but that term now, you've got to be careful with that term. We want to be clear about what we mean. It would be one of the major accomplishments of the retrograde religious conservative movement. Overturning Roe v. Wade after four decades, really pieces of 5 decades, actually. Actually, no, it's just 5 decades. I don't even have to hedge. Would be an absolute major accomplishment. And Trump is responsible for that. He's the guy who appointed the justices that made it possible. Let's go to the next clip. Here is Donald Trump now on the heels of what was it? J.D. Mandel. No, J.D. Vance winning his primary on Tuesday night. And J.R. Majewski winning his primary on Tuesday night. Trump feels emboldened about the power of his endorsement. And he's telling everybody else, if I don't endorse you, it's very bad.
I remember Joe Biden saying months ago at this press conference he had that he goes, he couldn't believe all these Republicans still afraid of Trump. It's like, oh, they're all afraid of Trump. Should Republicans be afraid of you, the ones that are not in line with you and your views?
Well, if they want to win politically, probably, because if I endorse them, they win. And if I don't endorse them, they don't win. I mean, that's almost 100% of the case.
Now, it's really more like 57% of the case. And I think it's really important to remember that although Trump did get 2 victories so far this primary season, and he may get more, there's no question Trump may get more. Trump's record on endorsements is pretty shoddy. It's kind of like Swiss cheese. First of all, he endorsed a lot of presumptive frontrunners and incumbents. And there's a major incumbency bias in American politics. And even given all that, his record is not that great. Like, it's hovering right around and slightly below 60%. So it's not actually true that everybody Trump touches turns to gold, but it may end up being true in 2022. Remains to be seen. One last clip here. Here's Trump talking about Disney. Of course, Disney now under fire for opposing Florida's Don't Say Gay bill. And people are protesting at Disney and they want to cancel Mickey and Minnie and all these different things. Anyway, Trump says Walt Disney wouldn't be happy with what's going on.
I think what's happened with Disney and what Disney's doing, Walt Disney is looking down.
What's he thinking?
He's not happy, okay? Walt Disney said, whatever happened to my beautiful Magic Kingdom. He's not happy. No, it's a terrible thing.
So anyway, there's Trump speculating on how Walt Disney would feel about the Magic Kingdom today, based on Disney's opposition to the Don't Say Gay bill. The Don't Say Gay bill is, of course, disgusting. And I hate theme parks and have no interest in ever going to Disney again. But I like Disney's taking a position on this. And by the way, Disney wouldn't take a position on this, I don't think, if they didn't calculate that it's probably an okay PR move to take the position that they did opposing the Don't Say Gay bill. A very strange interview with Donald Trump, but an emboldened Donald Trump on the heels of some primary endorsement successes. We'll have these video clips for you. If you're just listening to the podcast today, or maybe listening on the radio, we'll have these video clips on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show. Today, we're going to be speaking with Matthew Tai, known online as Laowai86 or Sea Milk, who's an American blogger well known for living in China. Matthew, so great having you on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's an honor.
So, I mean, I guess first, just to kind of orient our audience, how did you end up living in China for the period that you did?
Yeah, I'll give you the Cliff Notes version. But basically, I was, you know, bored out of college. I didn't really want to settle down and get a job immediately. I had just backpacked through Europe. I was like, why not go travel somewhere else? China wasn't even on my list. I was like, why not do some sort of gap year, maybe teach English abroad for a year and then come back home and then get a job. So I initially thought, you know, Taiwan sounds pretty cool. Interested in maybe learning Mandarin Chinese might be useful in the future. So I put up my resume on some Taiwanese job sites, and it just wasn't hiring season at the time. But I guess some mainland Chinese companies also poach like potential employees on those sites as well, because I got a phone call from this like tiny little school in Guangdong, in Huizhou. Actually, the picture behind me is the city behind me. Called me up and said, hey, do you want to do a year here instead? And I didn't really consider it. I was like, you know, China's seems like a pretty crazy place, but at the same time, why not go on another adventure and try it out? And, you know, sold all my stuff. I was just a young, you know, 22-year-old kid, and hopped on a plane and went over there.
And I have a number of viewers who have called me sometimes when we'll open up our phone lines, and they say that they are in China teaching English. What other things do Americans sometimes do in China when they're there?
Sure. Yeah. Like, so I didn't continue teaching English the entire time. It's kind of just it's the way you get, when you get off the plane, it's what you do. Right. But a lot of people, you know, they'll oversee factories. They'll, do consultation for like, what's it called? Like, quality control. They'll do, help with immigration visas and stuff for people that want to move abroad. There's people that'll start their own bars. You know, it's like, it's not an open market, but it's a huge market. So a lot of people, especially during China's golden period, which I call like kind of like when I was there, 2008 up until, I mean, I left in around 2018, but up until like 2014 was like a golden period for people to go there and try out a new market, go try a new product, try to get Chinese people interested in something that they can find a home that is not already popular in China.
So there's how to even broach this next part. I mean, there's no shortage of reporting about an authoritarian status quo in China to different degrees and affecting different people. We have the Uyghur population specifically, and we've done interviews about that. Then there's people like you who are Americans who may be there on a temporary basis, and your circumstances presumably would be different than someone who is from China and living in China. Just to get us into this, can you give us a general overview of what's accurate about the reporting that we hear about the Chinese government and what maybe is less accurate, generally speaking?
Sure. So when I was initially there, I mean, I didn't set out to cover any news or influence anything about China, other than the fact that I wanted to put out videos to show people that it's not the boogeyman. Like, people are like, what are you doing over there? Why did you move to such a crazy, you know, communist authoritarian country? And I just wanted to put videos out there to be like, listen, it's not as bad as what you think. Or maybe the things that you're thinking of are not actually true, at least in my life, from my perspective or my Chinese friends. Right. So that's what I initially did. And I actually moved into, as my channel got bigger and stuff, and I, you know, my business partner, people might know him out there, Winston. He's the first China vlogger, the first guy to actually get on a VPN and put out videos from China. I happen to be the second. We met each other. We started doing TV shows. We started doing travel documentaries. And again, our goal was we set up a small motorcycle business where we built our own custom motorcycles and we rode through the country. And we didn't go through the places like that, you know, people normally see, Shanghai, Beijing. We went through the rural countryside. We went through the small towns, the third tier cities, all these places that don't get reporting. So we wanted to show a human face of China. And we didn't set out to do that from the lens of like, oh, this is so unfair the way it's portrayed. We just wanted to show reality, right? So from that perspective, we developed our own insight onto what was actually happening in the country. And as we traveled more and the more people and relationships we developed, the more we realized that unfortunately, a lot of stuff that people talk about in regards to China are more of a macro scale. But China has a lot of issues, and a lot of them, I'm going to say the majority of them, do stem from the Chinese government. And when we would go to some of these villages and find out that maybe an official, for example, a local official, went unpunished after raping a 14-year-old girl and then having her murdered, we would be shocked to hear this. And it's weird because the people in this village, they normally probably wouldn't talk about that to anyone else. But because we were foreigners that showed up, there was some sort of like trust or understanding that we would understand. We would kind of get their perspective, and we wouldn't stick around long enough to face any repercussion. And the more people like that we met, the more beholden we felt to tell the story of actually what's happening. When we were in some of these far-flung areas, we would find out that the People's Liberation Army of China would go and harass families and harass tribes, like Mongolian tribes and things like this, for money to just keep them down. Their languages were being banned out of schools. The people would tell us stories about how they felt trapped because they're an ethnic minority and China doesn't allow them mobility or doesn't allow them to do really anything, especially upwards mobility, owning their own business, making money. And we found out that there's actually a lot more than what, you know, Western media is portraying. I think the Western media portrays a lot of, you know, financial-based things, or, you know, we'll focus on one specific issue, which is great. I mean, like, I absolutely focus on the Uyghur issue. It's a huge thing. I personally know Uyghur people that have gone through this. I'm in personal contact with people that have lost their families to the genocide in Western China. But also, like, the stories of the Inner Mongolian people, the stories of the ethnic minorities in the South. I became very dedicated to kind of compiling these stories in my head while I was there, knowing I couldn't report from China at the time, and then saving them for when I ultimately had to leave China.
So let's dig into a couple things you said. You said you, in some of the, you know, third tier cities, you wouldn't stick around long enough that there would be repercussions. And then you just said some of the stories you knew you couldn't report on while you were there. Why not? Why did you have to leave the cities? What would the repercussions be? What would happen if you tried to report on them?
So what happened was, when we would have the nicest of intentions, let's say we show up at a, you know, a third, fourth, fifth tier city somewhere down in Guizhou province. Let's just pick a random province in the south. And what would happen is, we would get, you know, of course you show up, you're a foreigner from the middle of nowhere, like you're in the middle of nowhere, and people crowd around you. They want to talk to you. They want to take pictures of you, all that kind of stuff. That's normal. But when you sit down with people and you start sharing a meal, when you start talking about things, and they, you know, you're not inciting these conversations, they're bringing these things up, and they start talking about what life is like there, how they haven't received any of the poverty, you know, alleviation type funds, how their town is going to be flooded by a dam that the government's putting in, even though that nobody wants it there. Those conversations perk the wrong ears. So, like, people will be in the background, people will be around there that have to report to local Communist Party officials. And what will happen is, they'll find out, you know, through the grapevine quite quickly that there's foreigners there and that they're not supposed to be there, because there are entire areas in China where foreigners are not even supposed to be. And you don't hear about this. This is, again, you wouldn't see this on reporting. You wouldn't read about this anywhere. But there are whole areas that are basically blacklisted off because the Chinese government doesn't want another Xinjiang story to break. They don't want another Tibet story to break. They don't want people talking about issues that are caused by the government leaking out to potential journalists, even though we weren't. So you would have a situation where you'd be in an area, and then you'd kind of get this inkling, this feeling that, number one, the hotels won't even let you stay there. They're like, no, we can't register a foreigner. You know, whether they got tipped off by someone or not, it's a different story, but they just won't even register you so you could stay there, so you're forced to leave anyway. But when you get the feeling that people are starting to, like, make phone calls, and then you start to see police officers and things like this, you know it's time to leave, because the times that we did stick around, we've been told by police officers that you actually have to get on your bike and just get the hell out of there.
Wow.
And what we noticed sometimes is, when we would be in these areas, later on, we would see actual police officers, sometimes in notepads or their phones, at certain kind of designated points on the road from the next, from where we just left to the next city. So we'd be monitored the entire time. And you realize that, you know, especially when you travel around rural China, you realize that it's very much akin to the security apparatus that maybe, like, a place like North Korea would have. It's just not as in your face, and it has more money.
Right.
So you're minded the entire time. And ultimately, we found out really how bad it can get when we were up in Inner Mongolia. And, you know, our hotel room was just full of SWAT team people. Wow. With body cameras and automatic weapons. That's when you realize that I'm here trying to film some horses and talk to some local people about their way of life. And then there's a SWAT team and detectives in my hotel room interrogating me about my every movement in the entire country.
Now, when something like that happened, after they're done interrogating you, do they leave and then you just kind of finish what you were doing?
No, that's the worst part, is that there's a system of, I don't know, I think they want to instill some sort of paranoia, because what they'll do is, I'll use the example in the hotel room with a SWAT team. What they'll do is be like, okay, we didn't really get what we wanted. You know, they list off where we work, what our contracts were, where we shop 2,000 miles away, by the way. They know everything about you. And they want to get in your head, because later on, they'll continue to harass you. So you think everything's fine. You'll leave super early the next morning to go on to your next destination. And then you get stopped by the army. Like that day, that later that day, early in the morning, we get stopped by the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, who made us take apart all of our equipment, check everything, take photos, told us not to smile in the photo, stand in front of everything. And they would leave. And then immediately they would come back and do the exact same thing over and over again until you just get out of their jurisdiction, right? At the same time, after your trip is over, the police still come to your house. They come to visit where you are. They come to interrogate you. Why do you own a drone? Why are you doing this, right? And it's this constant kind of harassment. And it's kind of the moment you realize that, hey, I'm not welcome here with a camera. They don't want people. They don't want foreigners walking around with cameras talking to people. And so that kind of false security you've built up over 10 years, you know, you watch that shift with the current regime, by the way. This really came to fruition maybe around 2015. It started getting really bad. But you watch this happen and it breaks your heart. And it also makes you feel like, what if the Chinese government's trying to hide this stuff so badly? There's so much under the surface that people don't actually know about. And that's what I feel beholden, you know, I feel beholden to the people to talk about today, because I get thousands of Chinese people reaching out telling me, please keep your voice up. Please keep talking about this kind of stuff, because we can't talk about that stuff.
Right. The social credit system, I've read quite a bit about it, specifically in the context of the Uyghurs. And we interviewed Jeffrey Kane about his book, and he, you know, writes specifically about how it's sometimes used to restrict the movement of the Uyghur people and in other ways. Can you talk a little more generally just about how, for the average person living in China, and maybe there is no such thing, maybe it's very different, urban versus rural or whatever the case may be.
Sure.
How does that system affect the average person?
Yeah, so the social credit system, I've done a huge, basically a documentary series on the whole thing. What it is it's more of a dynamic thing that's being tested out. So I think a lot of people, you know, I wanted to go out there and dispel this myth that it's some sort of number that hangs over your head like on Black Mirror or something. It's not. It's not that at all. In fact, it was rolled out in this place called Rongcheng in Shandong in northern China. And it was the first place that they rolled it out. And it's no secret. In fact, I found the government documents that are out there in public, and I translated them myself, and that's what I based my video on. And what it did was teach me how it works, you know, from a test standpoint, testing out on this city and its people, which it's mandatory there, but it's not necessarily something that's used elsewhere, right? There are other cities. In fact, I reached out to a lot of people around China to ask them if they even knew about it. I would say a good chunk of people hadn't even heard about it. But then there were other cities in Chengdu, and then I talked to people in Anhui. I talked to people all over China that did know about it. In fact, their city had some sort of version of it. And what it is, it's really trying to reward good behavior with a point-based system and then punish bad behavior. And unfortunately, when I went through those documents and I spoke to people around China, it looks like it's trying to reward good societal behavior, which is probably a fine thing. It's like, I don't have a criminal record, so my score goes higher, right? But unfortunately, a good proportion of those crimes, of those things that lower your score, are things about speaking out against the government, about posting messages of dissent on forums or on chat groups. Having weird religious beliefs, as they call it, you know, cult-like religious beliefs. It turns out that a lot of it is aimed at reducing personal freedom so that people don't dissent against the government.
once you're sort of branded or stigmatized or assigned, you know, a lesser status, whether it's specifically point-based or not, how do you recover from that? How can you get back to sort of being on everyone's good side, so to speak?
Well, unfortunately, if you're on like the low, this is what I pointed out in my video series, is that when I spoke to people, there's no, even though there's a sliding scale of points, if the government deems you the lowest score, you just get the lowest score. Mm. There's no rule of law or rhyme or reason in this. I think people really rely on this Western lens of like everything works to a certain standard. Everything works because of rules and laws. That's not really how it works. Like if China wants to throw you the lowest score and make you like ostracized in society, they'll just do that right off the bat, right? Especially if it's something about the government, or just throw you in jail. But if a person is like labeled at the bottom, I mean, your kids probably aren't going to get into schools, right? You know, you're not going to be able to get employment opportunities, at least above the lowest, you know, blue collar kind of construction type jobs, even if you're well educated. And to get out of that, if you're at the bottom, you're not going anywhere. But to get out of that, you have to do good deeds, right? You have to participate in local government activities. You have to, I mean, there are some clauses in these documents that say if you rat someone out, basically, that's doing bad things, then you get to move up. It's basically a really restrictive way of keeping people in their spot. They don't really want people to go up or down necessarily.
Mm.
It's almost like there is no recourse for people to exit once they've already been deemed that lower caste.
Last thing I want to ask about in the couple minutes we have left, you weren't there during the COVID lockdowns, but it's been widely reported that, you know, there are these videos of the vehicles pumping out disinfectant on the street, which is, of course, of questionable or no actual preventive value for COVID whatsoever. The COVID zero strategy of a sort of close to complete lockdown, et cetera, et cetera. Can you talk a little bit about whether any of what you read about in the context of COVID was surprising based on your experiences when you did live there?
No, honestly, like when I saw the heavy-handed approach of, you know, Xi Jinping's government, really not just when he took over, but like later on when he achieved full power within the Chinese government, when he consolidated that power through the anti-corruption drive and things like this, I wasn't surprised to see what kind of methodology was coming out with the zero COVID policy, because there's a thing within the Chinese government, especially true under the current leadership, is that they can't be wrong. So when the Chinese government set out to say, hey, look at the world failing with the COVID response, look at, we're going to be the ones that kind of deal with it very harshly in the beginning, but we're going to show the world as kind of as a brand how this authoritarian style government actually works, right? We can take away people's personal freedoms and stuff, but isn't that better than dying? Isn't that better than millions of people dying? And honestly, it kind of worked in the beginning. I think a lot of people were like, you know, China's pretty brutal, but at the same time, you know, look at how they've dealt with this. A lot of people didn't die in comparison to the rest of the world.
That's, I guess, if you believe the numbers, right? I mean, there's also a question as to, yeah, but of course.
Yeah, I'm always speaking like a normal reader that's
yes.
just looking at the news, right?
Yeah, right.
Let's pretend like you believe the numbers. So then people are in a position to say, you know what, this other style of governance, maybe they're not going to jump on it and be like, yeah, China's the future, China's the way, but they'll look at it and say, you know what, maybe this kind of reporting that I see about China is not really accurate.
Right.
And what happens is, unfortunately, when you get new variants, when you get something that spreads so crazy like Omicron, and then the rest of the world has found out ways to deal with it, whether it be mRNA vaccinations, things that have been proven to work, China didn't adopt those things out of face, to say that we have our own homegrown method. We have our own vaccine, which is not very effective, by the way, against
right.
Omicron. We have our own lockdown strategies, and we've already put in the work, so we don't really have to suffer through this anymore while you guys still have to. And the rest of the world's kind of saying, well, what do you mean? Like, it's not, number one, it's not as, the new variant's not as bad. Number two, a lot of our population is vaccinated. And number three, we have an actual dynamic approach on how to deal with it that doesn't necessarily restrict people's personal freedoms. And China says, nope, blinders on. We have zero COVID. We have zero COVID. We have zero COVID. And that can't be proven wrong. Because in the top-down leadership in China, There is no saying that the government was wrong about their strategy. They have to be right and see it through. And we're seeing where Xi Jinping is currently trying to get into his third term. He has to make sure that his policies not only worked, but nobody has any sort of dissent or disapproval with them.
Right.
So we're looking at a situation now where zero COVID is either going to change and rebrand to the to save leadership face, or is going to continue down this very draconian route.
We've been speaking with Matthew Tai, known online as Laowai86 or Sea Milk. Matthew, so great speaking to you and really appreciate your insights.
Thank you so much, David.
Well, I have an opportunity today to do two things that I think are valuable. One is debunk a false talking point that is spreading like wildfire. And number two, to remind everybody that the entire Tulsi Gabbard thing was a complete and total scam. Tulsi Gabbard, who I guess somebody thought was on the left at one point when she ran for president and when she was a Democrat, she continues to provide reactionary takes on Fox News. And last night, she provided a reactionary take that is a great opportunity to explain reality to her and to people in the audience and to make sure that we're all equipped with the truth about this question. Did the Supreme Court leaker commit a crime? Because for all the talk about due process that the right claims to support, they are increasingly demanding the prosecution and imprisonment of the Supreme Court leaker, absent any actual crime that we can point to that they committed. So let's start with Tulsi. You might be shocked that Tulsi appeared to express outrage that the decision leaked, not that women's autonomy will now be allowed to be restricted by states. She was outraged that we learned about this 3 weeks early. Let's take a listen.
To be heard, I think it's also critical to point out that this leak sets a very, very dangerous precedent for our Supreme Court for three important reasons. Number one is, first of all, this person is a thief who stole this information, released it with a very specific intent to try to incite protesters and intimidate and pressure our Supreme Court justices to make a political decision rather than a decision that is based on the Constitution. Number two, we have the fact that, the Supreme Court is not in place to legislate from the bench. People's representatives.
And yet that's exactly what they're doing with this decision.
State level, at the federal level, are charged to make laws, not the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court needs to make decisions based on the Constitution. And the Department of Justice, lastly, needs to go and prosecute this crime, which is exactly what it is, and make
what?
An example out of the person who leaked this information, because our Supreme Court justices cannot operate under the fear that they will have partisan political activists in their house intimidating and threatening their ability to do their job per the Constitution.
Okay. So Tulsi uses the word thief, and that sounds criminal. I don't know. Theft is illegal, right? But it wasn't that we know of a crime. So that's one thing I'm going to talk about. The second piece of this is she insists that this was someone who didn't like the forthcoming decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, meaning it's presumably someone on the left who leaked this in order to try to pressure the justices to change their minds and sometime between now and whenever the decision comes out, decide to preserve Roe v. Wade. I'll get to that part in a second. So let's start with the crime piece. This is not about your opinion of whether it was good or bad that this leaked 3 weeks early. I just want to talk about whether it's a crime. If to get to this document, someone at the Supreme Court hacked a computer they weren't supposed to have access to, physically trespassed somewhere, that could be a crime. We have no evidence of any hacking or trespassing right now. Secondly, Supreme Court draft decisions are not classified. That's another angle where this is sort this must be like a classified document. It's not. So there's no crime there either. If I want to be as charitable as possible and say, where could there be a crime here? Under the loosest interpretation possible, you could maybe be charged with stealing federal government property for your own use. It's extraordinarily unlikely that you would see that. It's not even clear that it would necessarily fit. Now, if an investigation starts and authorities interview anyone, the leaker or whoever, and you lie to them, okay, that's a crime. That would be making a federal false statement charge. But that's an if, okay? So there's no crime that we're aware of here. So why would anybody be prosecuted and locked up? Because that's what people like Tulsi and other reactionaries are calling for. Now, one other thing, if the leaker is a lawyer, they could be subject to an ethics probe. They could be subject to being disbarred. These aren't crimes, but they could lose their law license. Bottom line, firing, sure. Disbarment if a lawyer, sure. Crime, almost certainly not. No evidence of that at this point in time. Second part, they continue to assume, these right-wingers, that the leaker is a pro-choice left-winger, angry with the forthcoming decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, releasing this draft in order to try to put public pressure on the justices planning to vote in favor of overturning Roe v. Wade, so they will be scared and they'll change their mind and they will vote to keep Roe v. Wade. First of all, lifetime appointments, extremely good security. I don't even think it passes the sniff test that it would work if that's what the plan was, to intimidate the justices planning to vote to overturn. But I actually have another perspective here, which is we're only speculating. We don't know who the leaker is. The leaker could just as likely be a right winger who leaked this in order to try to lock in the justices in sticking with their decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. In other words, a right winger might say there might be justices who in this February draft wanted to vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. But now, maybe because it's May now, remember, this person might know what happened since the draft was written. Maybe the leaker is a right winger, doesn't like abortion, and says, wow, I found out that, I don't know, Gorsuch is thinking about actually voting to keep Roe v. Wade. I am going to leak this to make their names public so that they are less likely to change their vote, because that would potentially cause some kind of uproar or whatever. The point is, we don't know either way right now. At some point we might. Right now we don't know. And all of this is completely irresponsible, particularly saying that people who have not committed any crime that we're aware of or that can be articulated should be prosecuted and put in prison, as so many like Ted Cruz have been demanding. One other clip I want to look at related to the Supreme Court leaker. So we had a more serious discussion a few minutes ago in the context of what Tulsi Gabbard said about the kind of equal likelihood, based on what we know right now, that the leaker might have been someone on the left who supports abortion rights or someone on the right who's against abortion rights. We just don't know one way or the other. But now I want to play for you a clip from Newsmax where the host Grant Stinkfield, with absolutely no evidence whatsoever, speculates that it might be the not yet on the court but confirmed Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson who leaked the draft. Now, there's no evidence of that. She's also not on the court, and how she would have access to the draft, I don't know. But here's Grant Stinkfield's perspective.
We're not telling them what they can do to their bodies, though. We're telling them what they can't do to a baby, a precious life. And speaking of Ketanji Brown Jackson, who you just saw there, I find it suspect that the first leak coming out of the Supreme Court in history comes shortly after Judge Jackson is confirmed. I want to know if her law clerks, who I am sure have already been hired, possibly even working at the high court already, before her swearing in, have access to these draft decisions. She would be my first suspect when it comes to the leak, because Ketanji Brown
Jackson... By the way, Ketanji, they just can't get it right.
...Jackson is a radical left-wing activist, more radical than any other justice in the history of the Supreme Court.
I think what he means is as qualified as any other justice on the Supreme Court. So we don't know who it was. This is total speculation. It might have been someone on the left. It might have been someone on the right. We know why each side might have motivations to leak this. But Ketanji Brown Jackson is not on the court. There is no evidence that I was able to find that her forthcoming clerks are already at the Supreme Court with access to documents. There's just no evidence of this whatsoever. And understand, I don't know if this hypothesis is going to pick up steam. But the way that it'll work is Newsmax will float it without evidence. And then people on Twitter will talk about it. And then Tucker will say, there are many people saying it might have been Ketanji Brown Jackson. It's what he did with the vaccines, remember? There are people saying tens of thousands of people died from the COVID vaccines. I'm not saying that, but there are people saying that. And then all of a sudden, it's on Fox News at night. And then the next day, Fox News, the hard news program, say, Tucker Carlson last night said that. And that's how it gets into the news cycle. So we'll see what kind of life this hypothesis about Ketanji Brown Jackson being the leaker gets. I hope that it's not much, but there is absolutely no evidence. And it violates absolute and complete instinct where she's not even working there. There's no reason to think her clerks are there. There's no reason to think Ketanji Brown Jackson has anything to do with this. We have a voicemail number, and that number is 2192-DAVID-P. Here's an interesting voicemail about HIPAA, vaccines, and the Roe v. Wade decision. Take a listen to this.
Hey, David. I was just thinking this morning, why is it that when it comes to vaccinations, the Republicans are all worried about their HIPAA?
Yes.
But when it comes to abortions, that's everybody's business.
Okay, so I like the call. In truth, none of this really is about HIPAA. Remember that HIPAA is about privacy regulations that govern medical providers. It doesn't apply to legislators or journalists or whatever anyway. But the point here is a good one, which is with something that relates to communicable and contagious disease, which you could argue I am affected by the person next to me. They say, oh, you can't even ask about vaccine status, never mind require a vaccine. And yet here, when it comes to something that's non-communicable and is a personal decision, they seem to not care whatsoever about the ability of an individual to make the medical decision that's best for them with their doctors and the Council of Medical Professionals. That is absolutely a double standard. And I'm glad that it is being pointed out. But good luck convincing these people of anything. They're gone, to quote Alex Jones. We have a bonus show. We do it every day. The bonus show is an additional show that we do for our members. You can sign up at joinpacman.com and get instant access to the bonus show. You can also use the coupon code Obamna to get a discount.
Obamna!
Today's bonus show, we will talk about, remember all those issues with the unruly airline passengers in the immediate aftermath, I guess we would say, of the pandemic? Those unruly passenger problems have plummeted to a multi-year low. We'll talk about why and what's going on. Secondly, Intuit, which is the company that makes TurboTax, is going to have to pay a $140+ million settlement over their supposedly free TurboTax, which isn't really free. I have a lot to say about that, and we're going to talk about it. And thirdly, a judge has ruled that an Arizona prisoner is psychologically fit to be executed. How backwards is this death penalty, my friends? How backwards is this death penalty? All of those stories and more we will discuss on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com. Get access. Otherwise,
depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh. 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
RCT Pittsburgh. Meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh
would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh...
Let's get started. I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Data is indeed the lifeblood of public health. COVID has illuminated a staggering toll already that we have seen 14.9 million excess deaths, but it has also illuminated a staggering data gaps in countries. Too much is unknown and there is too much delay in getting life and death information.
The World Health Organization says the true death toll from the COVID-19 pandemic over the past 2 years is nearly 15 million people, including nearly 5 million in India alone. Both counts are far higher than official tallies. This comes as the COVID death toll in the United States tops the grim milestone of 1 million, also believed to be an undercount. We'll get the latest. Then, as the Supreme Court appears set to overturn Roe v. Wade, we speak to law professor Michelle Goodwin, author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women, and the Criminalization of Motherhood.
It's important that we understand that with the undoing of Roe v. Wade, just what's at stake in the United States for our democracy and the rule of law. And if we look at this within the context of our democracy and the rule of law, you see the potential for the Supreme Court to do a bit of cherry picking around equality issues, around privacy issues, about matters that relate to autonomy with people's bodies.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The World Health Organization says the COVID pandemic caused the deaths of nearly 15 million people worldwide through the end of last year. The WHO's estimate is nearly triple the 5.4 million deaths reported by governments. It's based on an examination of the number of excess deaths, that is, how many more people die than would otherwise be expected. The WHO's Assistant Director General, Dr. Samira Sama, announced the findings.
What we released today is a staggering number of 14.9 million excess deaths since the start of the pandemic, from January 2020 to December 2021, in a period of 24 months. What we also reported today is that majority of these deaths occurred in Southeast Asia region, followed by Europe and the Americas.
The Olympic Council of Asia says it'll indefinitely postpone the 2022 Asian Games set to be held in Hangzhou, China, in September. This comes as China continues to battle its worst COVID-19 surge since the early days of the pandemic. On Thursday, Chinese leader Xi Jinping said he remained committed to China's zero COVID strategy, even as Beijing reported new cases, increasing residents' fears of a citywide lockdown. Nearly 330 million people in more than 40 cities across China are currently on lockdown. That's roughly equivalent to the population of the entire United States. Here in the U.S., where an official count of COVID-19 deaths has topped 1 million, coronavirus infections have jumped by 50% among Transportation Security Administration workers in the 2 weeks since a Trump-appointed federal judge struck down a federal mask mandate for air travelers. Meanwhile, the FDA has restricted use of Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine over concerns that in extremely rare cases it may cause life-threatening blood clots. In southern Ukraine, Russia's military has reportedly launched a ground assault on the last holdout of Ukrainian forces in the besieged city of Mariupol. New video shows explosions at the vast Azovstal steelworks plant, where Ukrainian fighters say some 200 civilians remain sheltered from the fighting. The UN says it has dispatched yet another convoy to the city in its latest effort to evacuate more civilians. Meanwhile, Israeli officials say Israeli Prime Minister